copyright forum of Christian leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Well, let me start by saying something that might surprise you. I think there are many ways to prove Christianity is false. And what I mean by that is there are certain strategies that, if successful, are able to falsify Christianity. I mean, think about it for a moment. Our story begins in the beginning, God. And if the atheists are right and there is no God, then the story doesn't get off the ground. Okay? If Jesus never existed, those of us who are following Jesus, hoping to get something from that, are following a fiction. If he did live, but he didn't rise from the dead, then the Apostle Paul says that we are of most people to be pitied. You should feel sorry for us if we are believing in a resurrected Jesus contrary to fact. So there are lots of ways in principle of demonstrating that Christianity is false. If there's no soul, if materialism is true and naturalism is true and we're just meat all the way down and there's no soul, then there's nothing that survives the death of our body, nothing to go to heaven or hell. So our worldview has a lot of vulnerable points. Now, this is actually a good thing, because since there are ways to show that our view is false, or at least in principle, this also means that we can defend our view. It's in that realm. I want to talk here this afternoon about a different way that people have used to undermine or destroy Christianity that is very popular in our culture, whether you're in the States or in the UK or on the continent, that has for the last 40 years, has been very effective in undermining the convictions of Christians. And I want to just introduce by telling you something that happened to me when I was in a chiropractor's office. A chiropractor is a kind of doctor, where if you have like back problems, then you go in and they lay you down and they twist you and crack you, and that's meant to help out. And sometimes it does, I guess, but they should call it a chiropractor, you know, I think. In any event, the young lady was getting me ready for my cracking, and so I thought I would ask her a question, because I like to ask questions of people and engage and hear what they have to say and understand their views. I said, "Do you mind if I ask you a question about morality?" And she said, "Well, no." I said, "Do you mind if I ask you a question?" She said, "No, go ahead." She's getting things ready. I said, "Do you think that morality is relative, or is it objective or absolute in some sense?" And she said, "Well, what do you mean by morality?" I thought, well, this is not a good start, you know. Right and wrong, good and bad, that kind of thing. As I'm talking, I can see she's not really getting it. So I want to start with a clear case example. Murder. Is murder wrong? Well, I said, "Well, what?" She said, "Well, I'm thinking." And I'm thinking, what's to think about? This was the easy one, right? And so I say, well, let me make it simple. Torturing babies for fun, is that wrong? And here's what she said to me. She said, "I wouldn't want someone to do that to my baby." Now, I want you to think about the answer compared to the question. Did she answer my question? No, she didn't. I asked a question about the action, torturing babies. She gave me an answer about her feelings about the action. I pointed out, that's not what I'm after. I mean, I wouldn't like people to give me burnt toast, but that doesn't, just because I don't like it, doesn't mean that it's wrong. I want to know if at any time, in any place, under any circumstances, it could be okay to torture babies just for the pleasure it brings to a person. Long pause. Finally, she said, I think it should be up to the individual to decide. Now, I suspect that if this woman had awakened in the middle of the night to the screams of a child being tortured by that baby's parents because it brought them pleasure, she would have considered these people evil and barbaric and would have called the police, which shows sometimes when people are not thinking about it, their moral common sense comes to the surface and helps inform the circumstances. But it also shows how when I'm now having a conversation and she pauses to think about it, this woman cannot even bring herself to label baby torturing as an objective moral harm. So what's going on here? Well, what's going on here is the power of an idea. And the idea has a name, and the idea is called relativism. Now, I want to define this for you because there are actually different kinds of relativism. They all have something in common. It makes them all versions of relativism. Here I'm talking about moral relativism. All types of relativism are distinguished in the sense that the truth of the thing in question is simply up to the subject or the individual to decide. When it comes to morality, moral relativism is the idea that morality is up to the individual. Each person has their own personal point of view, and no point of view is better than another. Think here about the difference between ice cream and insulin, the medicine. When it comes to ice cream, you choose what you like. And different people have different flavors. And one flavor may be right for you, but not right for someone else. And no one sees a problem in that because ice cream is a matter of individual preference. It's true for you that chocolate ice cream is delicious, say. But we don't do the same thing with insulin, do we? We don't say, well, what medicine will control diabetes? We say, doesn't matter, whatever you believe. No, because there are right and wrong answers to those kinds of questions. You have to choose the medicine that will do the job. In relativism, morality is more like ice cream. On the view of relativism, morality is like ice cream. You have your own personal preferences. Nobody's view is any better or worse, ultimately, than someone else's. Sometimes the relativism is individual. Sometimes it's kind of a group relativism where our society has kind of decided this is the way we're going to live, but we can't impose our views on someone else. And see, this is part of what relativism is all about. The notion is that we have, in a sense, a right to our own private morality, but then we don't expect other people to like our flavor of morality. We don't push it on other people. This is an individual matter. Everybody's morality is equal and should be respected and tolerated. Okay, so this word tolerance is going to come up here in our conversation because you know this is part of this whole dynamic. Everybody does what's right in their own eyes, to quote the book of Judges. That's relativism, moral relativism. Moral objectivism is just the opposite. It's the view that morality is more like insulin, not like ice cream. Everybody's answer is not just as good as anybody else. There are true, objective, universal ethical principles. Sometimes people will use the word absolute to describe this. I think there's some trouble with using that word, but I'll just use them synonymously for the moment. In this case, we don't invent our morality, we discover morality. It's like we discover some scientific principle. And I mean it in the sense that the truth is out there in the object, it's not just up to me. Okay, now, so when we say, make the statement, rape is wrong, a relativist would mean, I don't like it. So a relativist is talking about himself, he's not talking about the action. an objectivist when he says rape is wrong. He's not just talking about his opinion. Yes, he does have the opinion that rape is wrong, but his statement is about the rape. It is not about the subject. It is about the object. Here, the object being an action. Now, I want to tell you, right now I'm not arguing for a view. I'm just making the options clear. So I'm offering the definitions. Why is this distinction important with regards to Christianity? I want you to think about this for a second. Christians are people who trust Jesus as their what? Starts with an S.
Savior.
Okay.
Savior.
Right. What does he save us from? Also starts with an S.
Sin.
Well, what is sin? Well, sin is a violation of God's objective moral standard, right? What if it turns out that relativism is true? If relativism is true, then there are no objective moral standards from God or anybody else. And if there are no objective moral standards, then there is no sin. And if there is no sin, then we aren't sinners. And if we aren't sinners, we don't need a Savior. And if we don't need a Savior, we certainly don't need Jesus. Or at least we don't need the Jesus that's insolent. Now, we might like the Jesus that's ice cream. And you notice in a relativistic culture how Jesus kind of becomes ice cream to people. He's my flavor. Try him to see if you like him. He does these nice things for me. Maybe he'll do the nice things for you. Now, I understand that sometimes when Christians say those things, they're giving their testimony and they're saying something true about Christ. But lots of times they're really kind of reflecting a more relativistic understanding of Christ. So this is a problem even in the church. So you can see now how when a culture is convinced about moral relativism, they have no good reason to take our claims about Jesus very seriously. And if they have some other flavor of ice cream that satisfies them spiritually, or maybe no spirituality at all, maybe they're naturalist or materialist or atheist, well, then they just don't need what you apparently need, Jesus. Remember, Marx said that religion was the opiate of the people. And some people say, well, I've got something else that turns me on. So you can see now how relativism's idea, when it gets settled in the minds of a culture, it hampers the ability for people to take our message seriously. Okay, so here's what I'd like to do with our time together. I want to expose what I call the myth of moral neutrality. If you think about relativism the way I defined it just a moment ago, you can see it trades on a kind of neutrality. You have your view, I have a different view, we are neutral with regards to each other. So I think that's a myth. It's presumed in our cultures, but I think it's a myth, and I want to show why it's a myth. And this moral neutrality is really the heartbeat of relativism, and it is also at the foundation of what people understand tolerance to be today. So if neutrality is a myth when it comes to morality, and tolerance depends on neutrality, well, then it's going to turn out that tolerance, or at least the way it's being exercised today, is also a myth. And so I want to expose the myth of tolerance. So myth of neutrality, the myth of tolerance, this is all part of showing the problems with relativism. And I want to show you very briefly how to answer the charge of intolerance when people level it at you because you have a moral point of view that you think applies to them. Oh, well, you're intolerant. Or nowadays people say, well, you're bigoted, you know. In any event, I want to show you how to answer that. There's a trick that people are playing on you. They don't know it. I want to expose that for you. And then I'm going to give you an argument against relativism. I think relativism is actually false as a worldview. And I'm going to give you a way of arguing in favor of relativism. And it's going to surprise you, I think. And then finally, I want to show you how Jesus fits into all of this. And then we'll have an opportunity for Q&A, God willing. I don't talk too fast. So first, the myth of moral neutrality. And here I'd like to read something written by American Faye Waddleton, who used to be the president of Planned Parenthood. Okay, You might imagine that I'm probably not in agreement with her on many things, but I'm not reading this to ridicule. I don't think that's a good idea. I'm reading it because I think it's a very effective way of expressing a view I want to critique. Sometimes relativism is expressed in very sophisticated ways. They're very convincing. And I think that's true in what Faye Waddleton has written. In fact, it is so convincing, many of you, after I read it, are going to think, gee, I think I'm supposed to disagree with her, but I don't know how, because it sounds so compelling. I'm going to sound foolish if I say no to that. However, there's a flaw in here, and you might catch it as I read through here. So let me read what Faye Waddleton writes about parenting and morality. Quote, "Like most parents, I think that a sense of moral responsibility is one of the greatest gifts I can give my child. But teaching morality does not mean imposing my moral values on others. It means sharing wisdom and giving reasons for believing as I do, and then trusting others to think and judge for themselves. My parents' morals were deeply rooted in religious conviction, but tempered by tolerance." So there's our word. "The essence of which is respect for other people's views. They taught me that reasonable people may differ on moral issues and that fundamental respect for others is morality of the highest order. I have devoted my career at Planned Parenthood, etc., to ensuring a world in which my daughter Felicia can inherit that legacy. I hope that the tolerance and respect I show her as a parent is reinforced by the work she sees me doing every day, fighting for the right of all individuals to make their own moral decisions about childbearing." And of course, she's talking about abortion on demand there. 75 years ago, Margaret Sanger founded Planned Parenthood to liberate individuals from the mighty engines of repression. As she wrote, "The men and women of America are demanding that they be allowed to mold their lives not at the arbitrary command of church or state, but as their conscience and their judgment may dictate." Okay. Then she closes, "I'm proud to continue that struggle to defend the rights of all people to their own beliefs. When others try to inflict their views on me, my daughter, or anyone else, that's not morality, it's tyranny. It's unfair and it's un-American." Close quote. Wow, that is really good writing. It sounds so sensible, it sounds so reasonable, it sounds so tolerant. But there's a fundamental flaw. Before I get to that, let me just ask a question if you've heard what she said. What is her basic view of morality as she's advancing there? Does she sound like she's advancing more of an ice cream view of morality or an insulin view of morality? An ice cream view, because she says things like we should trust others to think and judge for themselves, that Americans demanding they be allowed to mold their lives as their own conscience and judgment dictate. So Waddleton is relativistic here, promotes kind of a moral neutrality and non-interference. We should not we should be morally neutral, tolerant toward other people's, and note the implication, if we are not neutral, we are not tolerant. Okay, so that's where she's coming from. Now, what's the problem? What's the flaw? Here it is. Faye Waddleton is not neutral. Faye Waddleton is not neutral. Let me ask you this. Does she have the same neutral, non-interfering respect that she's describing here for the views of others who differ from her? Well, let's look and see what she says. She said, "I want to continue the struggle to defend the rights of all people to their own beliefs." But then she has this to say of those who disagree with her on this particular issue of abortion. "They're unfair, they're un-American, and they're tyrannous." Those are all moral labels, aren't they? Those are moral judgments. For example, do you think Faye Waddleton shows the same neutral respect for people who want to block the door of an abortion clinic because they think that's wrong? No, she thinks they're wrong. Now, she may have her reasons for objecting, I'm not taking that on. This is not about the pro-life issue at all. I'm just making an observation about this particular woman who is, in the one hand, championing a kind of moral neutrality on behalf of her view, but then with respect to other people's points of view, she is not neutral at all. Not only that, she is very happy to impose her own view on others. How do I know that? Because she said it. Where? Right in her piece. I have devoted my career to ensuring a world in which my daughter Felicia can inherit that legacy. Now, what does she do in her career? She's a lobbyist. That is, she goes to Washington, D.C. and tries to prevail upon congressmen and senators to pass laws to enforce her own convictions. She might as well have said, I have devoted my career to ensuring a world in which my point of view is enforced in law, because that's what she does. Now, not only that, just as a case in point, a number of years ago, U.S. Congress passed a law making it a federal offense to block the doors of an abortion clinic, because there was a time when pro-lifers would just stand in front of the door and they wouldn't let anybody in. So they passed a law against this. And the woman who followed Faye Waddleton as president of Planned Parenthood at the time was interviewed. And here's what she said about the new law. She liked the law, but listen to the language here and see if you can't catch this same contradiction that I was just referring to with Faye Waddleton. She said, this law goes to show that no one can force their viewpoint on someone else. Wait, what is the law intended to do? Isn't the law intended to force their viewpoint on other people who disagree? Of course it is. That's the nature of law. Now, I don't miss my point here. I'm not campaigning about pro-choice or pro-life. This is not my point. I don't object to Faye Waddleton trying to have an influence on the laws of our country. That's the way we do things in our representative republic. That's just fine. My point is that it's not neutral. Faye Waddleton implies that she's neutral, that she's unbiased, that she's tolerant. When she's not, she talks neutrality, but she tries to force her viewpoint. And this kind of neutrality is a myth. Now, I'm going to pause my notes for a moment because I just want to underscore this point because it's really important. The culture is filled with people who will find fault with you as followers of Christ and do so verbally and do so aggressively based on their presumption of moral neutrality, when in fact their objection itself is not neutral. It is meant to express a moral point of view that they have. You are wrong for doing what you're doing, blah, 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 blah. Well, wait a minute. If everybody's going to be morally neutral, how is it you're going to call me wrong? You say I'm wrong for calling you wrong, but you're calling me wrong. Do you see the problem there? So I want to encourage you just to keep your ears open for this. And when you hear it, don't get angry, don't make a fuss, just point it out with a question. I'll give you some examples of this later on, but this is foundational. Moral neutrality is a myth. Anyone who opens their mouth in a conversation that has moral factors to it is weighing in on one side of the debate. It's virtually impossible for them to say anything meaningful about the issue at hand without taking implicitly a moral position. And this is when I think it's entirely fair to point that out. It doesn't mean that they're wrong. It means that with regards to their moral assessment, although they may be, that's not my point. It means they're not neutral. And if their campaign is regarding neutrality, and that's what relativism is, they've already violated the neutrality. So keep your eyes open for that. Now, this kind of neutrality is a myth. Now, if tolerance is grounded in neutrality, and this is the way what I'm going to call postmodern tolerance works nowadays. Postmodern tolerance, which is not classical tolerance, is a big difference, is grounded in this neutrality. And it turns out that if moral neutrality is a myth, then tolerance is going to be a myth as well. And I think you'll see this very quickly in this explanation that I'm going to give you on how to get yourself out of the trap when people call you intolerant for some kind of moral point of view that you hold. All right? Somebody says, well, you're intolerant for that view. Okay. Whenever anybody calls you a name, it's really important to ask for a definition. Don't get offended, don't get mad, don't put up a fuss, ask for a definition. What do you mean by that? Now, this is important because it forces the other person to be clear about the nature of their objection. Once they are clear about it and they offer you some kind of definition, they get it on the table. What is often going to happen is they are going to be just as guilty of that thing they just accused you of as they think you are. And when you get the definition on the table, then you are able to tactically, in a sense, point this out, right? So when somebody says, you're intolerant, I say, what do you mean by that? That is, what is it that I'm doing that justifies you calling me intolerant? Now, characteristically on this issue, the person who's angry is angry because I have a point of view that I think is correct and should apply to other people too. Whether it's a moral point of view or a religious point of view, if I think that abortion is wrong or homosexuality is wrong or same-sex marriage is not a good idea or Jesus is the only way of salvation, these are all things that are wildly politically incorrect in our cultures today, and people push back very aggressively the minute that we voice that point of view, and they quickly call us names. You're intolerant. Now notice, by the way, they've changed the subject. I hope you see that. Because we had been talking about a topic, one of those things I just mentioned, and all of a sudden, with one move, they have switched the time, changed the subject from the issue to your personality. Something's wrong with you because you hold the view. They've changed the subject. Now, I want you to see that they've changed the subject, and your questions now are going to exploit that. Help them to see what they didn't see. So I want a definition. Well, the definition turns out to be something like, well, you think you're right. You think you're right and everybody else is wrong. Now, let me ask you a question. Do you think when I weigh in on an issue like some of those that I mentioned, do you think that I think I'm right? Yes, of course I think I'm right. I wouldn't believe what I believed if I didn't think my beliefs were right. I would believe something else, and I'd believe that was right. But I'm not the only person in this conversation who thinks he's right. And that's the key observation here. Yes, I think I'm right. Now, could I be wrong? Sure, I could be wrong on lots of things, and I'm willing to talk about it. But the other person in the conversation also thinks they're what? They think they're right too. So they're objecting to me because I think I'm right, and they feel comfortable calling me a nasty name. Yet they're just as guilty, if there is a guilt about this, because they think they're right as well. Now, I know that, but how do I put that in play? I put that in play by asking a question. And the question is, do you think you're right? Do you think you're right? You're taking a side on this. Is your view correct? Now, what are they going to say at this point? They can't say, my view is false. They hold their view because they think it's right too. Now, what they might do is they might do like I call it, the postmodern two-step. They might want to say, well, my view is right for me. And at this point, I'm going to say, well, if you're right just for you, then why are you talking to me right now? It sounds to me like you're correcting me. You're the tolerant guy, I'm the intolerant guy, I should probably be tolerant like you, right? So you're the right guy, I'm the wrong guy. Okay, you follow with me so far? Okay, now I have a final question. Remember how we went? He says, you're intolerant. I say, what do you mean by that? He said, you think you're right. Well, I do think I'm right, but do you think you're right? Of course he thinks he's right. Okay, final question. Why is it that when I think I'm right, I'm intolerant, but when you think you're right, you're just right? What am I missing here? No, this is not a rhetorical question. I want a response from him. I'm tossing the ball back in his court. This is the value, the tactical value of using questions to make your point. Incidentally, I've written a book on tactics. And the title, I'm going to write it down so you don't forget it. The title of the book on tactics is Tactics. Okay, it's available in the bookstore. There's only about 20 copies, so get them while they're hot. Since we're here at the board, so to speak, I'm Greg Kokel. The organization I represent is Stand to Reason, and our website is str.org. And this is probably the most important thing I'll tell you today. Thousands of pages of information at our website that will help you as a follower of Christ navigate through a lot of these things. I've been doing radio, interactive talk radio, for 25 years. That's available for free. You can podcast 3 hours a week. It's not burdensome. And there's a bunch of other things there. But this is a tactical approach. So I am trying to show a person is mistaken by using questions, and that throws the ball back in their court. Now, what am I trying to do with this tactic here? I'm trying to show him that he's gotten off the topic. That we were talking about an issue, now you're attacking my character. That's just bad manners. It's bad thinking. It's an informal fallacy called ad hominem, attacking the man, attacking the person. But it's also bad manners. What if I would have, when the guy says you're intolerant, if I would have said, and you're ugly? No, I wouldn't say that because that's bad manners and bad thinking. But how is it any different? He attacks my character, I attack his looks. Neither of us are talking about the issue. And what I want this person to see is that he's just gotten off the track. That he's chasing down the wrong issue. I was actually on a TV show in Canada, 1 hour TV show. Three people versus one person. There was a TV talk show host too. It's called Test of Faith, and I was the whole show was about pluralism, and I was making the case against pluralism, or the idea that all religions lead to God. The three across from me were all pluralists. I was the one who was not a pluralist, and I wasn't making an argument based on my Christian convictions. I told the audience and the talk show host, I said, I'm going to give you an argument that doesn't trade on my Christianity. I'm going to give an argument that anybody can use, regardless of what their own religious conviction is, to show that all religions can't be right. And it was basically making the point that religions have conflicting viewpoints. Either God is personal or he's not personal. Jesus is the Messiah or he's not Messiah. You can't be both. Can't be neither. You know, somebody's wrong on big issues, so they can't all be right. It's not bigotry. It's not intolerance. It's simple math. And when I'm making this case, of course, the challenges, you're intolerant, you're narrow-minded, all that started coming. And I just made the observation on camera. I said, you know, it's interesting how the conversation has went. We started out talking about a topic, pluralism, and somehow this conversation has gotten off the track onto Mr. Kokel, me, my personality. Mr. Kokel's arrogant, Mr. Kokel's intolerant, you know. I'm mean, I guess, is what you want to say. Mr. Kokel's mean. I said, okay, well, why don't I just accept that? I'll agree with you. I'm mean. How about that? Now we all agree that I'm mean. Can we kind of set that aside and get on with the conversation, things that we were talking to? So my attempt there was to narrate for the viewers, because my goal is to convince the viewers. It's not to convince the panel. To narrate for the viewers what these people are just doing. They're trying to make me look bad in a politically correct way, based on their neutrality and their tolerance and their acceptance of everyone, except for everyone who doesn't agree with them. And then they feel free to abuse them and call names. And this happens all the time. And this approach, these questions or something like that, will help you disarm that. So you can show that for the foolishness it is. You're not going to get mad. You're not going to call names in return. You want people to get back on the topic. So let's focus on, is abortion right or wrong? On the merits. Is same-sex marriage good policy? On the merits. Is Jesus the person he claimed to be or not? On the merits. Regardless of what you think of my personality and my character. That's a distraction. I want to get it back on the central issue. Now, Here's what I've done so far. I've talked about the myth of neutrality. And so we know that anybody in the conversation, they're not neutral. And it's going to be fairly easy for you to see this now. You might not have seen it before. Now you've been alerted to it, you will be able to take a look at that. By the way, I just remembered another book that I wrote on relativism, which is the topic of this talk. So how could I forget to mention it? Now, the book that I wrote on relativism, I don't want you to forget the title. The title is Relativism. All right? So, don't be fooled by copies. That's the authentic book, and that's also available downstairs in the bookstore until it sells out. The advantage of having only a small number of books available is later in the week I can tell classes I had my book down there and it sold out right away. So you'll have to go to str.org maybe to pick it up. So we've talked about the myth of moral neutrality, and I cover all of these things in the book on relativism. I don't talk about the myth of tolerance as something I've added since I've written there, but we talked about that. On our website, there's an article called The Intolerance of Tolerance, and you can find that there, or other places on the web where I talk more about these things. I talked about the tolerance trick, but I haven't offered any argument against relativism, have I? I have talked a little bit about some of the liabilities here, that nobody's really neutral, etc. But what I'd like to do now is I want to give you a more formal argument against relativism. And it's not exactly formal logic, but it's going to be, I think, a very useful way of making the case against relativism. And I am going to, if you want to convince somebody that something exists, one of the simplest ways to demonstrate that is to just point at it. Podium. Paper. You know, you don't need an argument, you can point at it. Now, morality, though, is not physical. So how do you point at something not physical? Well, actually, we do it all the time. See how they love one another. See how they love one another. Aren't we inviting people to observe something that bears evidence of some immaterial thing? We do this all the time. Our language is thick with this because the world is filled with immaterial realities that we are directly aware of and talk about all the time. This is one of the huge problems of naturalism, because naturalists deny what's obviously true. They're banging into reality all the time. Reality is what you bump into when you don't take it seriously. They're banging into reality all the time. There are many things that we know to be true by a faculty that philosophers call intuition. And I don't mean like women's intuition. No, I believe in that, ladies. Or the kind of some learned capability that you have. Maybe you're in a profession that after you've learned for a while, you get a second sense or a sixth sense, they call it, you know, about things. I'm not talking about anything you've learned. I'm talking about something that's built in. So, for example, if I were to say to you, all men are mortal, Socrates is a man, therefore, what? How did you know that? How did you know that? I always get the same response, and of course you're perfectly correct in that. How did you know that? Some people say, I learned it in philosophy class. No, you didn't. You didn't need a philosophy class. No. You can just, watch the language here, you can see that if it's true that all men are mortal and that Socrates is a man, by natural entailment, by logical entailment, then Socrates would be mortal. There's a rational relationship that we immediately perceive. Now, what would happen if somebody told you, wait, I don't get it. Socrates says, well, how do you prove it? You say, what do you mean, prove it? There it is. You don't see that? Now, what would you do if somebody said, prove it? You wouldn't be able to do anything. You know what you would do? You'd start at the beginning again. Oh, wait, you probably didn't understand me. Let me start again. All men are mortal. Did you get that? Yeah, I got it. Socrates is a man. Yeah. And therefore, Socrates is mortal. Huh? So you're going to think that there's something wrong with the person who doesn't get it, because it's right there. What you're trading on here is called a rational intuition. It is a rational capability that we have to see something that is real, but it's not physical. We use this all the time in rational discourse, even if we don't know formal syllogistic logic or something like that. Still, we employ it because this is part of what it means to be a human being. All right. And if somebody doesn't see what all of us can see naturally, we think there's something wrong with them, and that would be true. Now, I think we have rational intuitions. I think we have aesthetic intuitions. I don't think beauty's simply in the eye of the beholder. There are also moral intuitions. I made a reference earlier to moral common sense. Did you remember that phrase? If the woman who said, you know, it's up to individuals regarding torturing babies for fun, and she had woken in the middle of the night hearing the screams of the baby, well, she wouldn't be going, I guess that's the matter of personal opinion. No, she would immediately perceive, see, understand this is an evil act. In fact, one could point at the act, and the person who is in proper possession of their faculties would see immediately that something is wrong here. So this is the way I'm going to argue. All right? My conviction is that everybody has these faculties, and they use them all the time. And it is in evidence in their language. That is, their language gives them away with regards to their deeper convictions. Even though they will claim that they are moral relativists in the way we just described it, that is not the way they act. Which is why I can read Faye Waddleton's statement about moral relativism and find within it objective claims she's making. It's the reason why nobody's neutral. So I'm going to position these things as a number of fatal flaws to relativism. And in each particular case, I am going to be trading on something that the person already knows and has language that they use to communicate it, but the language requires that morality is objective, not subjective, for the language to be meaningful. Okay? Now this will make more sense when I start giving you some of the illustrations. Okay. First flaw, and this is the biggest one if you remember, no others, this is all you ultimately need. Okay. In 1982, I lived in Thailand. I worked for 7 months in a Cambodian refugee camp about 50 kilometers from the Cambodian border. It was my job to make sure that 18,250 Cambodian refugees were fed. Everything that they ate came through my hands. I ran the entire feeding program. It doesn't mean I cooked all the meals, but I arranged for all the food to be brought into the camp and distributed, and cooking fuel and the whole thing. 56 tons of rice a week, 3,000 hot meals in the hospitals, 9 tons of fresh vegetables. Now, these dear people were the survivors of the Cambodian Holocaust from 1975 to 1979. This is when the Cambodian communists were in control of the country. And it wasn't until the Vietnamese attacked from the east in 1979 that broke the stranglehold of the Khmer Rouge, the Red Khmer or the Red Cambodians. And the people were allowed to flee and cross the border and take refuge in Thailand. And during those 4 years, starvation was commonplace. People ate snakes and bugs and even bark. Some women ate their own children. executions were routine. People were tied to trees. They had plastic bags. If you've been in Southeast Asia, you know they use these little blue plastic bags for everything. They'd put them over their head and tie it. They'd suffocate. They'd eviscerate the people tied to trees and pull their guts out. They would, the slightest infraction would be a trip to execution. If you were educated, you spoke one word of French. If you wore glasses, if you hid food, you would get executed. Infants were tossed into the air impaled on bayonets. They were thrown in big tubs of water, and they were allowed to rot there. And then the people were forced to drink the water in the tub. They called it the baby broth. By the time the Vietnamese invaded and the Khmer flooded into Thailand, 2 million, according to Time magazine, had died. That's half of the population. Through starvation, torture, execution, the bodies were piled in ditches, they were hung from trees, they were floating in the rivers, they were bulldozed into mass graves. They came to be known as the killing fields. It's the greatest act of genocide ever perpetrated by one race on its own people. And the camp was thick with children, and I still have copies of pictures that the children, the 10, 12, 14-year-old children, drew of their experiences, the blood-red graphic depiction of executions that these children witnessed. I mean, it's enough to make a person weep. But why do we weep? Oh, well, we're just being emotional. Are we? I think there's something else going on. There is a reason that we react to that. When we countenance what took place, or just what took place down the road here 50 years ago in Auschwitz. I saw a friend of mine yesterday who had made the trip out and was back. I said, hey, how are you doing? He said, I'm emotionally exhausted. When we countenance that, something occurs to us. We are not morally neutral. We understand what happened there, and the way we assess what happened there and in Cambodia is that the things that happened were, and what's the word we use to describe it? Evil. Now, I have another question of people who make that characterization of those behaviors. When you say the things were evil, are you describing yourself? Are you merely describing your feelings, or are you describing your culture's assessment, or do you mean to be describing the things themselves? And of course, to a person, they mean to be describing the things themselves. In other words, what they see are actions that took place that have the quality in themselves of evil. And if that's true, that is, if their assessment is accurate, then relativism is false. The easiest way to demonstrate that relativism is false is to point to the problem of evil. And the problem of evil is on the lips of every critic of theism. It spontaneously comes to their lips. It is the most prevalent objection against theism, Christianity in particular, and it is the most durable, and it's one of the hardest to answer. But what has to be true for the problem itself even to exist? Morality has got to be objective, not subjective. And if morality is subjective, if it's just a matter of individual opinion, well, then, there is no evil in the world. There is no evil. The problem of evil is the most obvious evidence that relativism is false. Now, this is just one flaw. The second flaw, and all of these are going to be kind of joined at the hip a little bit. They're going to be similar here. If there is a real problem of evil, if somebody in the world, and I don't know, Osama bin Laden or Hitler or Pol Pot or George Bush, I don't pick your poison, it doesn't matter. If that person thinks somebody is really evil, then relativism is false. And they know it, is my point, okay? And by the way, in relativism, there's no good either. Good is a fiction in relativism too. Here's the second thing. Relativists can't accuse people of doing something wrong. If relativism is true, it does not make any sense to say somebody's done something wrong. That's like saying that they've broken a rule in a game with no rules. You go out and kick a ball around, you know, play soccer. Now, I don't know enough about soccer to be able to make this example work. I think of American football. Okay, so you're just going to have to put up with that for the moment. So you're just throwing a football around. What are the rules? We're not playing any game, no rules. We just toss it around. And then after somebody says, illegal forward pass. What? Out of bounds. What do you mean? There's no boundaries here. This game has no boundaries. How can I be out of bounds? And the same thing applies here. In relativism, morality has no boundaries. So how can people say somebody's out of bounds morally if relativism is true? Okay, so what sense does it make to say gay bashing and racism are wrong if it's a relativist that's speaking? You know, I saw, now who's the Brit that did the TV show in America now for, I guess he's not doing it anymore, but he followed Larry King. What's his name? Piers Morgan, okay. I thought he's a much better talk show host than Larry King, but he was kind of a bully. And I guess he's, you know, he got in trouble. I guess he's not on the air anymore. But he had that nice British accent, so it was pleasant to listen to it in some ways. But he's also kind of a bully. I saw him on the air with a Christian man who had the conviction that homosexuality was wrong. And he immediately said to the Christian man, he said, Elton John is my friend, and he just is married to his lover, and they just adopted a baby. So who are you to say that Elton John is wrong? So that's the challenge that's offered. Now, here's the proper response. Who are you to find fault? Let me do that a little slower, because I think it went over some of you. Who are you to find fault? Now, look at the relativism knife cuts both ways. If a person is going to say, you can't judge me or Elton John or anybody else like that because such judgments are mistaken, then their own judgment of the judger is out of bounds. On the one hand, they're claiming there are no moral rules. That's a defense for their own view. And then in the next breath, they're leveling a judgment. So what's it going to be, Piers? Do we have objective morality or no? If we don't have objective morality, then I'm nobody to say he's wrong, and you're nobody for saying I'm wrong, for saying he's wrong. If there is objective morality, then we can both put our moral claims on the table and make a case for them, and you can't dismiss them by saying who's to say or who are you to say. So what's it going to be? So there's my question. Now, I've never had that conversation with him, but I've practiced it a number of times. If it ever should take place, it won't. But I hope you see the point. In relativism, you can't accuse others of doing wrong. I'm going to write his name here in the corner, Piers, so I don't forget it. Piers Morgan. I couldn't watch that show because I'd get so mad. That's true with most TV stuff, so. Here's the third flaw. Relativists can't demand justice and fairness. Why not? Well, these are two concepts that make no sense at all in a relativistic world. Justice and fairness represent how we ought to be towards other people. You ought to act justly. You should be fair. Wait, ought, should? That's moralistic language. Do you mean it's just your personal opinion? Or do you mean that that's an obligation that I really have that applies to me? Of course, they mean the second, not the first. But that makes no sense at all in a relativistic framework. Now, look, the words don't have any meaning, the concept of justice requires ideas like innocent and guilty, right? But if there's no guilt, no true moral guilt, innocent, guilty, themselves moral notions lose their substance. But people use this language all the time. They talk about justice and fairness and innocent guilt. And why? Because they can see the moral truths resident in the universe. Now, this doesn't mean that every single moral truth is easy to figure out and how it applies to any given situation. Moral decision-making is sometimes difficult. But I'll tell you something, moral decision-making would be impossible if relativism were true. This is another flaw. It would be impossible. How do you assess, judge between one action or another if moral relativism is true? You just decide what you want. That's all you can say. Here's what I like at the moment. Here's what our culture, our group, our linguistic community likes for the moment. And then you change, a couple weeks later, you change your view. So relativists can't complain about the problem of evil, not consistently. They can't accuse others of wrongdoing. They can't demand justice or fairness. They can't promote tolerance. Well, wait a minute. I thought like tolerance was the big plus for relativists. It's not. It is incoherent in relativism because the way relativists advance tolerance is as a moral obligation. You ought to be tolerant of other people. Well, that's a contradiction of their view. Now, I do think we ought to be tolerant, but I think tolerance has a very particular definition, the classical understanding of tolerance, which isn't being practiced today. It's just the opposite, frankly. But there are virtues like tolerance, and I think we have a moral obligation to pursue those kind of things. But that's because I'm an objectivist. Makes sense in my worldview. It does not make sense in a naturalistic, relativistic worldview. So they cannot justifiably help themselves to tolerance. Now, I have seven major flaws. I've just covered four. I'm concerned about the time here. You can find the rest in the book. See, I give you enough to annoy you, and you got to buy the book and read the rest. But I think you get the picture here. You could probably think of your own flaws in which people are really acting inconsistency with their relativistic claims. So what kind of world would it be if relativism were really true? It would be a world in which nothing was wrong, nothing could be considered evil or good, nothing is worthy of praise or blame. Be a world in which justice and fairness would not make any sense whatsoever, no accountability, no possibility of moral decision making, and in which there would be no tolerance. And the pursuit of relativism produces that kind of world. Now, people aren't consistent, obviously. On Tuesday night, I give the plenary session on naturalism, and I'm going to make the claim, or the point, that the way to deal with naturalists is to trade on reality. We have reality on our side. And most of the things we want to persuade naturalists are true, against their view, are things they already believe, but they don't know it. And so we have to find a way to get them, a shrewd way to get them to understand that this is one of them, morality. And the fact that they raise the problem of evil consistently shows that they deep down inside, they have an immovable conviction about objective morality, even though on the outside they want to complain. And so what ends up happening, and this is going to be your tactical key to dealing with this in conversations, they are actually living in two different worlds. And this is an insight that I got for Francis Schaeffer, that since Christianity is true and the Christian worldview is accurate, when someone denies some detail of the Christian worldview, they are denying some detail of reality. But they have to live in reality. And reality is what you bump into when you don't take it seriously. And so consequently, whenever they deny reality, there are going to be times when they're going to be banging into it. And it's our job to keep our eyes open for it and then point it out. And so when they raise the problem of evil, as naturalists, they have a contradictory circumstance. Their worldview tells them that there is no foundation for morality, objective morality, yet they're complaining about the problem of evil, which shows they believe in objective morality, and therefore they have a conflict, okay? And our job then is just to point that out. Schaefer called it the point of tension. We just see where, hey, what's going on with that? They are bumping into reality is what they're doing. And so we're going to try to point that out. And I've given some examples already, because nobody can live this way. They can talk this way, they can't live this way. And so in that same chiropractor's office, there were the physical therapist who was helping me out, I was talking to him about spiritual things, and he objected at one point about a moral point of view, and he said, you know, you Christians are judgmental. Now, when he said that, he made a mistake, but he didn't know it. And maybe you don't see it yet, but I wanted to make it more obvious. And I said, his name was Gil. I said, Gil, what's wrong with that? He said, well, it's wrong to judge. Okay, now I've got it. He's made a statement. It's wrong to judge. What is it that he just did, by the way? He made a judgment. Now, I could have said, hey, you just made a judgment. Gotcha. But instead, I used my tactics. I used a question instead, and I said, Gil, if it's wrong to judge, why are you judging me right now? And he had never heard anything like that before. He just dropped back for a moment. He's scratching his head, and he finally says, you know, I guess it's okay to judge, because he realized he'd gotten himself into a corner. But you can't push your morality on other people. Then you've gone too far. Now, he thought he'd improved his situation. Had he? No, because I had another question. I said, Gil, is that your morality, what you just expressed to me? It's wrong to push your morality on other people. Is that your moral point of view? He said, yes. I mean, God bless him, so blithely. Yes, that's my moral. He didn't realize. He just jumped into another hole. And so I asked another question. Why are you pushing it on me right now? Well, he got all frustrated, you know. He made a couple of false starts. He couldn't get going. And finally, he says, well, it's not fair. I said, what do you mean it's not fair? I guess I could have said, if you're claiming it's not fair, that's a moral claim too. But what do you mean it's not fair? And he said, well, I can't find a way to say it, which it sounds right. I said, it doesn't sound right because it's contradictory. This is called the suicide tactic, by the way, when you show that a person's point of view self-destructs. In any event, I've had people at this point of conversation where they tell me, they said, well, now you got me all confused. And I said, well, no, you were actually confused when you started. you just figured it out. Okay, so the basic tactic here is, and there's more I could say about this, but we're almost out of time. One other point I want to make. There's more. The basic tactic here is to use questions to help the person see that they are doing the thing that they tell you not to do. All right? Somebody says, you shouldn't push your morality on other people. You ask, why not? What are they going to say? It's wrong? Oh, is that your morality? Why are you pushing it on me? If you don't think it's right to push your morality on other people, why are you doing it right now? Okay, so that's kind of the move. There are different variations of this, and I've got a number of examples in the book. But I want to tell you something else here. If relativism is false, which clearly it is, then objectivism is true. And this has explanatory power. It explains why people feel guilty. I was lecturing at Berkeley a number of years ago, and I got to this point in this talk. And I said, why do we feel guilty? How about this? Maybe we feel guilty because we are guilty. Is that in the running? The answer to guilt is not denial. That's relativism. The answer to guilt is forgiveness. And this, I said, is where Jesus comes in. Now, on that particular night, it was Friday night. I also had a lecture on Saturday night where I was going to talk specifically about Jesus. So I told the audience, this is where Jesus comes in. And if you want to find out how he comes in this spot, you have to come back tomorrow night. You know, so it turned out we filled the gallery again the next night. But I want you to see what I did, though. I started out with kind of a philosophical issue that was really pre-evangelism, to bring me to a point where I could then address the existential reality of that person, what was going on inside of them. Are they feeling guilty? Yes, everybody feels guilty. Because everybody is guilty. This is the human condition, and we can kind of ignore it for a while. We can't ignore it forever. And we have an answer for that. as followers of Christ. So the goal of showing that relativism is false is to help people to face two things that they know, even if they don't always admit it or they're not always immediately in touch with it. We're helping them to see this. First thing that they know is that the universe is filled with moral obligation pertaining to human beings. And the second thing they know is they do not satisfy those obligations. And that means they're in trouble. That's bad news. But we've got good news, which is a substantive answer to reality. All right, well, that's enough for now. I have 4 minutes that I can take some quick questions if you'd like. My apologies for talking so long. That's what I do, so. Yes, sir. The question was, well, it's okay to be intolerant to people who are intolerant. All right, well then, by that, this is more nonsense. Okay, it is just, this is like the person says, it's not, how did that, it was a sign on campus, it's not wrong to think you're right, but it's not right to think others are wrong. This is more nonsense. When you think you're right, that just means you're thinking other people are wrong. And the person who's making the statement on the sign is thinking that those that they're opposed to are wrong. So they're violating their own dictum. So in this particular case, it says it's right to be intolerant to intolerant people. Okay, so you're admitting that you're intolerant then. Okay, well then why are you complaining when others are intolerant to you?
Yes.
We're following your rule. The opposition can offer these kind of clever little slogans, but it's not going to get them out of their bind as long as they stick with a postmodern view of tolerance. Classical tolerance is what I believe. Okay? Classical tolerance has two parts. Okay, and this characterization I get from Peter Kreft of Boston College. The first part is be egalitarian towards people. That is, you treat human beings with equal respect and dignity. The second part is be elitist with regards to ideas. When it comes to ideas, some ideas are better than others. All right? Nowadays, this is topsy-turvy. People are egalitarian regarding ideas, or they say they are. And if you don't agree with their celebration of diversity, then they can be elitist regarding you as a human being and abuse you and call you names and do all that kind of stuff. So tolerance has become intolerance. It's gone topsy-turvy. So when somebody's asking me about this and comparing it to Nazis and stuff like that, I'm going to say, look, I believe in classical tolerance. I believe in treating you with respect even if you disagree. I think your point of view should have an airing. You don't have the same feeling about me. And I'm treating you like the opposition here. Your idea is if I want to come in and say same-sex marriage is not a good idea and here are the reasons why, you respond, you're a bigot. And you scream and yell and you get rid of me, okay? American football player last week was just drafted, homosexual, kisses his sweetheart on the TV in kind of a gross way in front of everybody in celebration. Another football player tweeted, here's what he tweeted, OMG, horrible. A defensive lineman. He got benched, he got fined, and he can't get back on the playing field until he goes to sensitivity training. OMG, horrible. This was his crime? This is the kind of thing I'm talking about. So there's no tolerance whatsoever for opposing points of view, whether they're just emotional responses like that was or an intelligent line of thinking or argument. There's no tolerance for that, okay? So our side, the classical view, is the one that can really show tolerance in a virtuous way. The other side doesn't do it. And even those little slogans like that, they don't get them out. They make them feel good about themselves. They're preening, but it's nonsense. It's foolishness. That they have capitulated there and they've decided we're not going to have any conversation. We're just going to be mean to you. Okay. My time is up, and I thank you so much for the time we spent. Don't forget str.org. God bless you all. Thank you.